Welcome to the American Cafe. I'm your host, Ira Melman. The state of California is drying up.
Right now, we rely on a lot of snow and rain, and that's not happening.
Mike O'Sullivan joins us from Los Angeles on what is being done to conserve water there. At the largest prison in New York City, inmates who have mothered children are being given a new way of connecting with them, courtesy of Carnegie Hall.
For them to have the opportunity to write a song for their children is really, really a nice feeling. And that's where you see their face light up because they feel like, wow, I'm really doing something. And I'm doing it in a jail. That's unheard of.
Jeff London is in the cafe to tell us more. And Carolyn Weaver joins us with the story of how a new television series is bringing many members of the Asian American community together.
It's a moment for our community to shine, for us to see one of our own on TV.
All of that and more on this week's American Cafe. California's Governor Jerry Brown says residents of that state must reduce their water consumption by 25% to cope with a major drought. Local communities are drawing up new restrictions. Mike O'Sullivan reports that residents, businesses, and water agencies are already making changes.
This is the fourth year in a row of below-average rainfall, which has created moderate to extreme drought conditions. Bill McDonald of the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California says new restrictions should save a precious resource that is drying up.
Right now, we rely on a lot of snow and rain, and that's not happening.
Some of the state's water comes from Northern California and moves through aqueducts to the farm-rich Central Valley and water-hungry cities in the south. Farms use 80% of the state's water to produce much of the nation's fruit, vegetables, and nuts. Farming is largely exempt from the new restrictions, but many farms have seen their water allocations cut to zero. They use groundwater for crops, and new rules for pumping it may help preserve the water table, which is being depleted quickly in some places. Analyst Katrin Chappelle of the Public Policy Institute of California says the public wants stronger conservation measures.
Our recent survey asked the question, do you think local and state government is doing enough about the drought? And we saw the majority say no.
Among new rules already in place, restaurants will face fines if they offer water to customers who have not asked for it. At a Mexican restaurant in Los Angeles, owner Gilberto Satina says the rule will save more than just drinking water.
It's the water, it's the ice, the electricity you use to make the ice, the cup when you get the water, or if you use glasses, the water you use to wash the glass.
Californians say they want to help.
We could just to do what we can. We turn off the water in between brushing our teeth.
Major water users, such as golf courses, will face new restrictions, and local communities are drawing up rules to meet the target of a 25% reduction by next year. Some homeowners are being paid to tear out grass and to landscape with drought-tolerant native plants. Bill McDonald says more homeowners are installing efficient drip irrigation systems.
And that's the future. That's where we're going, because putting drinking water on a landscape that's ornamental is not a good use of resources.
Analysts say there is no single solution to California's water shortage, but education, better planning, and conservation will help the state get through its periodic droughts. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Some 70,000 mothers are serving time in U.S. prisons. They rarely see their children, get to touch them, or even sing them a lullaby. Female inmates in New York City are getting a little help with that last item, thanks to Carnegie Hall. For the past few years, Carnegie has sponsored the Lullaby Project. It pairs professional musicians with women in jails, homeless shelters, and city hospitals, among other places, to help them write lullabies for their children. Jeff London spent a few days with the musicians and inmates at New York's largest jail, Rikers Island, to see how the Lullaby Project works.
It's a frigid morning, and five professional musicians have made their way through a maze of checkpoints to a small classroom where they'll work with 10 prisoners, women who are either detainees awaiting trial or women who are serving out their sentences at Rikers Island. After they meet each other and sing together,
Tiffany loves you, love is magical, love will keep you safe.
Naisha.
The women move to different corners of the room to start writing lullabies. The first thing they do is write letters to their children in workbooks. There are some suggestions. Start sentences with, I hope, I wish, or I wonder. In one corner, Kelly, the Department of Corrections will only allow the women to be identified by their first name, is working with Indian classical singer Falu Shah. The two have come up with a chorus.
You and I go together, all right?
Okay. 1, 2, 3.
I wonder if you know how much I love you. I wonder if you know how much he loves you. I wonder.
But Shaw says she really had to coax Kelly to write her lullaby.
She was actually crying. She was very sad. And, you know, we were talking about our kids, my child and her child, and we just connected becoming mothers for a second because she was not able to write anything. So I started talking to her about my son, and then she started to talk about her four children. And that's where we connected, and that's where I could get this out from her, because sometimes a participant needs a personal touch. They need to know that I'm safe.
The song is written from two perspectives, Kelly's and that of the children's late father.
They lost their father recently, and fortunately the two younger children, they don't really know much about what's going on. And even though me and him weren't together, he was there for the children. And so I really wanted to get the message to the older ones especially that their father's still around and that he's looking down on them so that they feel some sort of comfort, you know, since I can't be there physically.
To be able to give those children something, anything, means a lot, says Veronica Scudder, who helps coordinate programs for the women at Rikers Island.
For them to have the opportunity to write a song for their children is really, really a nice feeling. And that's where you see their face light up because they feel like, wow, I'm really doing something. And I'm doing it in a jail. That's unheard of.
When the day ends, the musicians leave and get to work, says Falu Shah, in a Manhattan recording studio a week later.
The minute I left Rikers, we came home, we charted down everything that was on the recording, line by line, who wanted what, tunes, because we have to learn the melodies, and then think about what the arrangements will be like. So that process starts right away.
She and the musicians have gotten back together to lay down tracks for all the lullabies, including Kelly's.
I wonder if you know how much I love you. I wonder if you know how much he loves you. I wonder if you know how much I love you. I wonder if you know how much he loves you. I hope you know how much I love you when I'm not with you. Please stay together and love each other forever.
A week later, the musicians have returned to Rikers to play their finished lullabies for their co-songwriters. Kelly is overwhelmed by Falu Shah's setting of her lullaby.
And now that I heard everybody's songs, it's just, they're all so beautiful. You know, when it comes to our children and stuff, maybe it brings out the best of us. We all became songwriters for them, I guess, right?
The Lullaby Project is expanding beyond New York City and Carnegie Hall. Several arts organizations around the country have begun their own lullaby projects.
I wish you both feel
For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
It's been two decades since an American television show featured an Asian American family. So it's not surprising that Asian American viewers are excited about a new situation comedy fresh off the bone on the ABC television network. VOA's Carolyn Weaver pays us a visit from New York. The show is about a Taiwanese American boy and his family.
It's the mid-1990s, and Eddie's family is moving from Washington, D.C.'s Chinatown to Orlando, Florida.
I don't know why we have to move. Why couldn't you keep on going back and forth between Orlando and D.C.?
Because I didn't come to America to work for your mom's brother selling furniture for the rest of my life.
For Herb Tam and his friends, fresh off the boat, the first American TV show in 20 years featuring Asian Americans is a signal event. He says it's almost like when basketball player Jeremy Lin vaulted to fame.
That sense of elation that, you know, one of us had finally made it into this big stage, that there was this depiction of Asian American life that resonated not just with us, but clearly with non-Asians too.
So Tam, a curator at New York's Museum of Chinese in America, and some of his friends have been gathering to watch the show every week at this Chinatown restaurant. His friend Vincent Fang calls it a rebirth.
You know, Asian Americans have always played a supporting role in TV, but they've never been the main characters, right? And this is just one of those, it's iconic. And I think that it's a moment for our community to shine, for us to see one of our own on TV.
11-year-old Eddie, played by Hudson Yang, has to cope with being different in a new, mostly white school. And even though he identifies with hip-hop culture, he doesn't fit in instantly with African-American kids either.
Yo, man, what you doing?
Get used to it. You're the one at the bottom now.
No, I'm not.
Yeah, you are. It's my turn, chink.
Fang says the show, which is based on a memoir by Taiwanese-American chef Eddie Wang, mirrors his own experience growing up in a mainly white culture.
I think the show also does a good job of showing the subtle racism that a lot of, you know, Asian Americans grow up feeling and grow up experiencing. I certainly felt it when I was growing up.
Fresh Off the Boat has garnered enthusiastic reviews, and the show has been the most watched in its time slot for many weeks, pretty much guaranteeing that it will be renewed for next year. Carolyn Weaver, VOA News, New York.
Cash has not disappeared from everyday life, but the world's largest information and financial companies are working on ways to replace it with wireless communication payments. Sweden is in the forefront, with between 85 and 90% of all transactions being made electronically. As VOA's Bernard Schussman tells us, the task is formidable, and there is some strong opposition to a total change.
Cash, clams, dough, scratch all mean the same thing, money that one can hold and use for any kind of purchase or purpose. Is it losing favor worldwide? According to John Sheldon of MasterCard's Innovation Group, the move to a cashless society is picking up steam worldwide, especially in Africa.
They have the opportunity to leapfrog the existing infrastructure that, say, exists in Europe and North America, because, you know, they can, you know, just like in China, they skipped right from the PC to the 4G phone. You know, societies in Africa, Latin America, Southeast Asia have the same opportunity to skip payment technologies right straight to the mobile phone and doing mobile payments instead of, you know, going through all of Magstripe to, you know, the chip and beyond. So they can move much more quickly because those infrastructures don't have to be put in place.
MasterCard has been working with Nigeria and South Africa to reduce fraud by using so-called proof-of-life technology, which allows for cashless transactions once a user is identified.
I'm going to make a purchase, and actually I'm validating that purchase with a picture of my face. Use that photo. So it's establishing me that it's me. It's actually validating me. It's looking for my password. And therefore, it's validated that I'm here and I'm alive, and then I can make that purchase.
Across the continents, money keeps being printed. But Cornell University professor Robert Hockett says cashless transactions are a necessity in many countries.
It's often hard to find banking services, right, to find institutions that are located in one conveniently reachable place at which one can make one's deposits or meet with one's bankers or the like. So it ends up being quite convenient to be able to sort of carry around your bank with you, as it were, say in the form of a single electronic device like a mobile phone.
Scott Shea is chairman and founder of Signature Bank in New York City. He cautions against a totally cashless world.
Once we get to the point where there is no currency, no cash, essentially every single transaction that any individual makes is susceptible to being monitored and, even more worrisome, controlled.
Is the public sold on total electronic transactions? Outside of United Nations headquarters in New York, Huda Alzera of Bahrain summed it up.
Maybe electronic payments are good for online stuff for certain things. They're really good for globalization, actually, you know, because, like, you can pay online, you can get things from different countries. So it's good for that electronically. But I feel like for everyday life, it's good to have cash on hand.
According to monetary experts, there's a huge cost for countries using cash, including printing money, securing money, and distributing the cash. But even in nearly cashless Sweden, two-thirds of Swedes think carrying cash is a human right. Bernard Chessman, VOA News, New York.
The first women-only mosque in the United States recently opened in Los Angeles, California. Its aim, empowering Muslim women by being more welcoming to female worshipers than traditional mosques. Since its opening, the Women's Mosque of America has been generating discussion about a women's place in Islam. VOA correspondent Elizabeth Lee is in the cafe with that.
Once a month, Muslim women gather inside a place called the Pico Union Project. It is a multi-faith space for an experience unlike any other in the United States. Tanzila Ahmed got a taste of it firsthand.
I came here 2 months ago, and it was so empowering to be surrounded by women of all ethnicities, all races.
Unlike most traditional mosques where men and women are separated and men lead Friday prayers, the Women's Mosque of America is for women and led by a woman. Edina Lekovich gave the sermon on opening day of the mosque.
When I stepped up to the plate, I felt that I was connected to the women in the audience and realizing that we were all there for the same reason, because we wanted to reconnect to our faith or take the next step in our faith, and that we wanted to try something a little different.
Something a little different because some Muslim women say they have always felt like outsiders in the traditional mosque. That includes Ahmed.
In the mosque that I've been growing up in, we were always kind of shuttled into a back room. We weren't allowed to be in the same space as, you know, where the sermons were being held. What was empowering about this was I didn't even have to think about that. I didn't have to worry about the patriarchy issues that I usually have to deal with when going to a mosque.
The women's mosque does not have a dress code. Many choose to cover their heads, a few do not. The women pray in a building that looks like a church on the outside and has stained glass of the Star of David on the inside. Besides Friday prayer service for Muslim women once a month, it also houses Jewish and Christian events. Founder M. Hasna Masnavi says she picked this place for her ideal mosque.
Something that really inspires me are the golden ages in Islam. And this was a time when Muslims, Jews, and Christians all worked together.
But as Tanzila Ahmed discovered, not everyone believes an all-women's mosque is necessary.
There was a lot of comments in relation to the article that I wrote saying how it's un-Islamic to have women lead prayer, to have their own space, and I think that's just wrong in so many ways.
Islamic scholars say while it is acceptable for women to lead other women in prayer, it is debatable whether that includes the shortened midday Friday prayer or the sermon. The discussion about women's role in Islam is not new, says Brie Lascota at the University of Southern California, American Muslim Civic Leadership Institute.
The Women's Mosque itself is not an isolated event. There have been a lot of critiques of women's roles and the limited and narrowed nature of many of those roles in Muslim institutions for many decades. And that has come to a head, especially with sort of the Gen X millennial Muslim women.
Lascota says the Women's Mosque is a response to this issue with uniquely American characteristics.
There's a large focus on interreligious dialogue. There's a great focus on pluralism and how do you exist in a plural context. There's a great focus of diversity.
And for the women who attend the Women's Mosque, a focus on spirituality. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
Musical groups from more than 50 countries played at the 2015 South by Southwest Music Festival in Austin, Texas recently, including two groups from Russia that represented two different approaches to attracting an American pop music fan base. As VOA's Greg Flakes reports from Austin, both Mummy Troll and Pompeia are looking beyond Russia for commercial success.
The group Mummy Troll hails from the Pacific Coast city of Vladivostok, and its musical influences come from rock, electronic dance music, and Japanese punk. Growing up in the port city, lead singer Ilya Lugutenko says he spent a lot of time tuning into music from nearby Japan and even U.S. military stations.
It was like, you know, whatever you heard, you know, it influenced you immediately because it wasn't the stuff you hear on the local radio.
He writes the songs he sings, but he says whether singing in English or Russian, what really matters is how the music connects with people.
Show me one person who would understand lyrics from day one when you hear it on stage. Sometimes, you know, you feel the energy. That's why you like it. So we're trying to combine both.
The group Pompeia has a completely different sound, influenced heavily by Western pop music from 30 years ago, according to lead singer Daniel Broad.
It's a new wave with a little bit of funk and disco.
Pompeia is from Moscow, but in the past few years, they've spent a lot of time traveling outside of Russia, especially in the United States. They rented an apartment for their stay in Austin so that they could feel more at home.
We really enjoy the traveling. We travel and we introduce our music to the people.
Keyboard player Sasha Lipsky says Russians sometimes show up for their shows in cities like New York, but he says the audience is still 90% Americans or people from other ethnic groups.
And that's really good because it shows us that we pretend to be an international band, not a band for Russian immigrants.
Through concerts and online videos, Pompeia has attracted fans in this country as well as other parts of the world. Daniel Broad says the group has many teenage fans in Russia, but in the U.S. it tends to be people who were in their 40s and listened to this style of music when they were young.
And those people are older than we, and they go like, wow, you're playing the music from my teenage years.
Greg Flakes, VOA News, Austin, Texas.
That is all the time we have for this week's program. Our thanks to executive producer Bob Doty. If you'd like to hear more about these stories, check our website at voanews.com. And we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email from wherever you are to our studios in Washington, D.C. You can email us at americancafe@voanews.com. Why not give us a telephone call? Dial the international code, then the number 1 for the United States, followed by 202-205-9942. When you hear the VOA ID, press 05 and then leave your questions or your comments. For all the folks here at VOA, I'm Ira Melman. We'll see you next time on American Cafe.